legally commit acts of criminal acts against them. Mm-hmm. And so when you hear violence, don't for one moment think that violence is only illegal violence, as you see, like demonstrations and like the riots. That's one sort of violence. And that is well known because everybody focuses on that. But throughout our land, there's the illegal violence against the youth in the ghettos. East LA, you know, the police kills on the average about 2 or 3 Mexican-American youth every week. And throughout the ghettos in America, you know, the police kill maybe tens, maybe even 100 every week, Negroes, with legal violence. So there's two sorts of violence. And every time that illegal violence is committed, you can bet your last dollar that it's against the poor. Whether it's a Negro, a Mexican, or whatever he is, a Puerto Rican in New York.
Well, what kind of people do you work with? I mean, they're not all just Mexicans, are they?
No, they're not. We have in our group, in our union, the Mexican is the largest ethnic group, but there are Puerto Ricans and Negroes. See, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Negroes. Then we have Anglo-Saxons. Oh, these are the Okies and Arkies that came from, you know, from the South during the Depression. And then we have, we have a few Arabs, and we have some Japanese, and we have some Indians from India, Hindus, and we have Portuguese that they've been bringing in lately. And God knows what else.
Well, I've read the book, The Grapes of Wrath, and in an article they relate it so much to was it just because the migrant workers are related to you in your life? What is your opinion of this book, The Grapes of Wrath?
The Grapes of Wrath? Which one?
By Steinbeck.
By Steinbeck?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, the book was on the poor, on the farm worker, but it dealt mostly with the dust bowlers. So these are the people who left Oklahoma and those states and came to California. They were all Okies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they went through the same things that we're going through. In fact, we were here when they came. But it's just that maybe instead of being Chavez or Garcia, it's Smith or Brown or, you know, something else.
Mm-hmm.
Same people. Poor, with no organization, no power. They may be white, but they're still the same as poor. You know, they're poor as we are.
There's one other question I think is important, and that is you often hear that some minority groups are played off against other minority groups. We can see this in Delano now in the Mothers Against Chavez, which is a small group of people we call scabs, who are, pressure is put on them by right-wing forces, by people who are against helping the poor. And they are, as we say, played off against people like the union. And the impression is created in a lot of people's minds. You know, there are two sides in the story. There is a large group of farm workers or poor people who don't believe the union is a good thing. Could you comment on Caesar on the way, not only in this case, but in the case in which the establishment or the powers that be use one minority group against another?
That's an old trick, you know, divide and conquer. It's been used. It's attributed to communists, but let me tell you that many, many people use it. And they're using Delano. The whole idea is to divide a section of the farm workers into an opposition group. But if you examine this, it goes even further, because what happens usually is that there's someone who is dissatisfied, and when, for instance, you were to examine all the farm workers and you would ask them, do you want better wages? And there wouldn't be one that would say no. Everyone would say yes. And then when you ask them, do you want better working conditions? Everyone would say yes. And then if you ask them, do you want a union? Then not everybody would say yes, because a union implies, you know, they know, a lot of hard work. But also, they know that they can't have these things without a union. But they know that if they get a union, then their life becomes a little uncomfortable for a while until, you know, that has to be done is over. So here in Delano we have a group of people who are being led by it's a women's group called Mothers Against Chavez, the lady who was leading them is, was working with one of the ranches that we organized here, and she was very much against the union because she had a better deal with another union. And so when the union came, she wouldn't join the union, and we had an agreement with the employer that all those who wouldn't join the union would have to leave their work, their job, you know, it had to be, everybody had to be a member of the union, because the majority of the workers voted that. And so she wouldn't join, so she had to quit, or the employers, the company let her go. And so she's very dissatisfied. And this is the, really the reason, you know. And also, you know, there's, I don't doubt that she thinks that she's doing a good thing, you know, by just opposing the union. But we've had others who were opposed in the beginning, and then we found, they have found gradually that they really couldn't be, because we thought we are for the same thing, so they've been coming around lately. But this group is quite active. This is about the third group that they're organized against. The other two sort of, there's one, there's a sign there, that used to be an independent union organized against us. And that was like an illegal thing, so it was done away with. And then there was another one, another group called the Delano Citizens for Facts, and that also disappeared. And now we have the Mothers Against Chavez, and they'll probably disappear. We'll come up with the Fathers Against Chavez, and that'll disappear. We'll come up with the Sons Against Chavez, and maybe that'll take for a while. So it's just part of life.
Could you tell me where you were born and raised?
Well, I was born in Arizona, in Yuma, but I was raised, I suppose you could say, all over California, because I didn't have any one place that I could call home. I lived, you know, as a migratory worker, so I went up and down the state.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, about your family life, what was it like during your childhood? This is my own question.
Well, I think it was no different than what it is for the kids who are now, you know, part of, well, whose families are migratory families.
Mm-hmm. You see, and your family life at that time, I read an article that said it's quite a few interesting pieces about your family life. What you that interesting?
Well, I guess you're referring to somewhere there was an article about our schools, how many schools we attended when we were small. And because we were moving back and forth, we attended something like 37 schools. And so we never went to a school longer than 4 or 5 months. This is the kind of life that we had. So it was different from those, well, in those days, generally Mexican Americans were migratory workers, more so than what they are now, you know. Mm-hmm. Very few people who were residents. And so it was quite different from what the normal Mexican-American child is faced with at this point.
Mm-hmm. How did you get involved with helping farm workers, or just get involved in this?
Well, you know, being a farm worker and going through all of the pains that migratory workers go through, and knowing the needs of justice, I think it was a very easy thing to do. To, you know, to just sort of, because of my own experience, become involved in this other activity.
Mm-hmm. Well, what exact cause started what made you start all these strikes, in other words, you know, to get involved with people, to get together with them, to form strikes against farmers?
Well, I maintain that the biggest, the one biggest problem we have is not so much education or assimilation or all those nice things that we hear, you know. The biggest problem that we're faced with in terms of social justice and in terms of progress for our people is economics. In other words, if the people have enough money, then they can take care of themselves. They can go to school, they can buy homes, they can do all these things. So in order to do that for any worker in America, in fact for any worker in any part of the world, the only way you can get more wages is by organizing into a union. And so we set about trying to organize into a union here in Delano. And when we approached the employers and asked them to sit down and begin to negotiate a contract, to sit down and recognize that workers have a right to organize, they said no. And so then, for a number of days, we went back and forth trying to get the State Conciliation Service. We tried to get other people involved to talk to them so that we could discuss the matter. And instead of having a strike or an economic fight, as we call it, we would reach some conclusion, some agreements by discussions. When we tried everything and everything failed, then the strike was called. And so the strike is for the purpose of forcing the employer through economic pressure to meet with the union and accept his responsibilities of giving the worker, in this case the farm worker, the right that he has to form his own unions and to bargain collectively.
Did you march to Sacramento? Was that a great
deal
of help?
Well, in 1966, we started here in Galeno on St. Patrick's Day, a good Mexican day. And we marched and we arrived in Sacramento on Easter Sunday. This was in April 10th of 1966. Well, we had a lot of, we made a lot of friends in the march, and we had many, many people come and join with us, and we sang and we prayed and we marched and we did a lot of things. So this, well, what happened was that if we took the strike to people who had never seen the strike or the strikers, and instead of, you know, like waiting for them to come here, we went to them and we told them what our cause was. It was what we thought was a just cause, and the cause was social justice. So it made, I think, a great impact on them, and it was very beneficial to us.
Mm-hmm. Who did you speak to in Sacramento, actually,
When we got there, we spoke to about maybe 15,000 people who had been following us, and to a number of state and federal legislators. But I think even more important than that, it was just the fact that for the first time, people were organizing and were willing to do things at great sacrifice to show everyone, not only in California but throughout the country, in fact throughout the world, that we feel we're so right about what we're doing, that we're willing to sacrifice and show through our sacrifice that we are really deserving of these things we're asking. In other words, the whole question of social justice, and so we're not afraid to sacrifice to bring that about. Mm-hmm. We accept it as part of our lives.
Mm-hmm. What do you feel about the religious, you know, fathers coming into this and getting involved in this?
Well, you know, the church has to get involved. But it is already involved. It is already involved in the side of the growers. So we want the church to get involved and be a part of what we're doing here. Because, see, what we're doing really isn't that strange to the church. In fact, maybe what we're doing here has a lot to do with our own Christian traditions. I mean, a lot of what we're doing here has to do with our whole upbringing and our education in the church. Because it is there that we find that the highest authority in the church since 1890 at least has been almost at every, certainly in the biggest and the most important encyclicals, it stated very clearly that workers have a right to join the union. First of all, that there should be justice, there should be charity. And then from there it says that workers have a right to form a union, and the reason that workers have a right to form a union is to be able to bring this justice about. And in Pope John's encyclical, he even went as far as saying that workers not only have a right to form a union, but an obligation to form a union, and also a right to strike in order to form that union. And so really what we're doing is what the church has been teaching us for all these years.
Well, in your lifetime then, priests have had a great impression on you, right?
Well, see, we didn't belong to any organized... As a migratory family, we didn't have, for instance, that I know of, we never belonged to any church organization, to any school organization, to any... to any of those groups that maybe you join now, you belong to in your school, because we weren't around that much. So the only place that we go to and were identified with was with the church, and really with those priests who were kind and understood our problems, so we really wanted to help the migratory worker. And so, yes, we found some very good friends there. And, the whole beginning of the, began to understand, in other words, getting the encouragement that a union could really be formed against all the odds that were faced that were against, came from some priests.
Well, I guess I kind of touched up the question that I want to ask you, what help would you like to receive from the Catholic Church now? So, I guess you can touch that.
Well, yeah, we have one very important thing. Here in Delano, what we're doing is very controversial. Because here in Delano, almost everything that moves, almost everything that has any being, you know, is in some way either touched or partially or maybe completely controlled by the growers. So our strike, similarly, in our church, stays in the same boat. Anything that we do here that offends the growers, offends the church, or offends the local priest. And so what we want here, what we need here is, more than anything else, is a priest that will administer the needs of the strikers and somebody who, for instance, you can't really go to church and have that priest up there knowing you, knowing very well that he's against what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And speaking against it, how can you, you know, be really a part of that church? So what we say is, we don't care if the growers have their priest, fine. Well, we'd like to have one priest that would feel the way we do and have him then administer to our needs.
Well, what good does your union do besides raising the wages for farm workers?
I think the most important thing is not raising the wages, although that's very important. I think that it gives the workers a sense of worth. Say, when a group of people have never had any strength, when they've been totally disorganized, when what they say or do doesn't really mean anything to anyone except what their own labors will produce for some grower, then the point that they come together and they begin to organize themselves and begin to see themselves that they can, through their own actions, change things, especially their lives, you know, as regards to wages, working conditions, and other matters that they're involved in, then this is what we call the dignity of the man, and this is the important thing, to know that he has that dignity. But that doesn't come through preaching, or it doesn't come through writing, it comes just through people getting involved and experiencing, and I think this is the most important thing. The dignity that was long ago taken away from them comes back to them through their organization. And now in this case it's a union, but it doesn't have to be a union. A union can be a political party, it can be just a group of tenants, it can be a group of just community residents.
Well, do all the workers show a lot of enthusiasm with these, or are they kind of stricter?
Well, those who are in the union, most of them, well, first of all, those who are in the strike do have a lot of enthusiasm because, you know, they know more and better than anyone else what the union really is all about, because they've been now out for 28 months. And so all of those sacrifices, all those headaches and heartaches that they go through, it takes more than just enthusiasm. It takes some kind of, you know, understanding, real deep understanding of what they're doing. Then those workers who have been organized and who are now working on a union contract, know that the value of the union. And then there are many who are enthusiastic, and but they're very far away from us and we can't really be with them. So we do it through mailing and so forth, through mail and so forth. And then there's a group of workers who are afraid, who may like the union, but who are very frightened by their employers. And so they don't, they may be enthusiastic, but they don't show it.
Well, what does your movement mean for the Mexican-American people in the United States?
Well, I think that if it means anything, it may mean that really something can be done through the strength of getting together and organizing. Because, see, nowadays you hear so much about people who say, well, we can't really do anything, our government doesn't really pay attention to us. Or, what is the good of organizing? What is the good of an organization? And so this is the one important lesson that we've learned here, and maybe we hope others will learn, and that is that you can do something. You can do an awful lot if you get together and work together.
Do you get much help and cooperation from the elected officials, like the governor and the senators and congressmen and so forth?
Well, some governors. We don't get any help from our present governor. So there are some senators that we get an awful lot of help, and especially both Senator Robert and Senator Edward Kennedy are most helpful to us. They've been very good. And then there are a number of congressmen in California throughout the country who are also very helpful, and they're very interested in what we're doing. It's shown someone a lot of help. We haven't had any help from the administration or from the president. Mm-hmm. Very little, hardly any concern whatsoever.
What is your opinion of Ronald Reagan?
Well, Ronald Reagan is on record as being against our union, so he's against those things that we're trying to do, not only in the union, but anywhere that poor people are getting together to do something for themselves. He seems to be, or he is against them. So we can have a very good impression, and we think that he can't represent everyone with that attitude, and he certainly doesn't represent us. So as far as we're concerned, we don't have a governor. Or if there's a governor there, but we can't get to him, he won't listen to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's because the growers, the growers having to, he's too concerned about the growers, and so he can't be concerned about us. That's just, one of those facts in political life.
Well, about Johnson, what are your opinions of him, opinion of him and his administration?
Well, with President Johnson, there are a number of laws that exist now that have not been enforced and should be enforced by the administration, by either Johnson or his administration, but it's not being done. And so we've, on many occasions, we've let him know what the problem is, and he refuses to, or he won't move to do anything to enforce it. So we can't have a good opinion of a man who is not willing to face his responsibility, and he has some concerns for farm workers.
So you do want changing the ideas of the administration and and Johnson to help the farm workers, right?
I would say so, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're on strike with the Gamera Vineyard Corporation now. Why don't they sit down and agree to a contract with the union?
Well, there are many reasons, but the first one is that farm workers don't have coverage under the National Labor Relations Act. Many years ago, the federal government passed a law that stated that when workers wanted a union, they could do so by voting. In other words, a group of workers get together and petition the government. The government comes in and conducts an election, a secret ballot election. If the majority of the workers vote for the union, then the government, by law, forces the employer to recognize the union and to bargain with the union, to sit down and talk about a contract. But when this law was passed, this was in 1935, they excluded farm workers. And so we don't have the law. So the only way we can get Gamera to talk to us, if he doesn't want to talk to us and cooperate, in other words, if he doesn't want to do it when we approach him and try to get him to come to sit, and discuss the problems with the union, then the only way to get him is through economic pressure, and that means that we have to strike him so that then economically his business hurts so much that he then wants to make peace with the union. And so really what happens is that the union never calls a strike. The union is always forced into a strike because if you, say for instance, if you were an employer and I am 100 workers and I say, Mr. Employer or boss, we want you to sit down and talk to us. We have a grievance. And you say, no, get away from here. I'm not going to do it. Then how am I going to force you to do it? Well, by not working for you and keeping other people from working for you. And then you can't raise your crops and you begin to have these problems that you would have if you don't have people to work for you. But then the employer would hope, like the others, will sit and then begin to discuss that. But see, all of this suffering that people go through are unnecessary because if we had the law, then all these things wouldn't have to be. It would be done in an early... For instance, in Fresno, you live in Fresno, Well, in Fresno, I would say that on the average of maybe 100 unions are organized every year in Fresno, and you never hear them. Yes. Well, every day they're organizing. You don't because you have a law, and they go in, the government comes in, has an election. It's a very simple matter. Now, many years ago, when they were trying to organize in Fresno, like during the First World War, Fresno was one of the rough towns to organize in. In other words, you know, they were very hostile unions. And there were many, many movements by many people in the unions in Fresno. Fresno, along with Sacramento and San Francisco, were considered to be about the three best towns for the union movement. And there were a lot of interest and so forth from the people. But nowadays, with it, you don't hear that because you have a law, except if you're striking farm workers, then you create a lot of interest. Mm-hmm.
What are the big obstacles that stand in your way of organizing 300,000 farm workers now living in California?
Well, I think that time is essential. No matter how successful we may be, we need time. But, of course, the fact is that we're not being that successful, or that at least that successful that we can organize that quickly. And one of them, again, comes back to the whole question of if we had the right under, we had the law that would give us the right and set the procedures for organizing, we could do it a lot faster. But even more important than that, the most important thing is that growers, the farmers in California and the other places, have not yet accepted the fact that workers have a right to form a union. And as long as they don't accept this, as long as they think that workers aren't human beings with rights to have their own clubs, their own unions, then we'll have a problem. For instance, the growers know better than anybody else how important it is to have a union because they have all kinds of cooperatives and associations. Those are unions. Those are their own unions. And they like all of these things. But the moment their workers want to form an association, they don't like that at all because they know how effective those associations are.
Can you tell me what your goals are for the future?
Well, immediately we have to continue organizing workers, to continue to develop those workers that are now organized so that they take a rightful place in their community. See, the whole question of participation at the community level, sometimes people who are very anxious to help the poor really don't understand that the reason the poor don't participate in their government is because it's expensive to participate in government. People say, well, no, it's free to vote, you know, and to register, you don't have a poll tax in California. But really, it is expensive. Because if you're going to participate in government, you have to keep up with what the government is doing. You have to be able to read, take time out to go to the meetings, and all these things become expensive. Now, people who are middle class don't think of it as an expense because that's a part of their lives and they're willing to do these things. The poor automatically think it's an expense because if you're so poor that you have to save your gas, like tonight, you can't go any place because you won't have enough gas to go work tomorrow, then you're not going to go to a meeting in your car tonight because if you go to that meeting, you can't go to work tomorrow. And so again, it's a question of economics. And so if we're building the union and people are getting more money begin to make a better living, then we want them to become a part of the community, to vote and have a say-so, to be able to really be a part and have a full say-so as to how the community is going to be run. And, gradually we're going to develop this. The goal, of course, would be to organize all the farm workers. And I'm not going to see that in my lifetime, but others will. We'll just see the beginning of that goal. Mm-hmm.
What is the name of your wife?
Helen.
Mm-hmm. How many children do you have?
I have eight children. Five of them are teenagers.
Oh, what are the ages?
The 19, 18, 17, 16, and 15. And then I have, 11, 9, and 7. So 10, 8.
What effect does this have on your family life, you know, moving around and everything, and different opinions of what you're doing? How does this affect them?
Well, it has, a lot depends on how, you know, what is said and done. For instance, in the beginning, it was a game for them. In the beginning, you know, they used to, because the publicity was favorable, and everybody not in Delano, but outside, the press and the TV, the radio, the newspaper, the magazine would say good things about the union, sometimes good things about me. And so the kids liked that. But they had never realized that sooner or later, not everything would be kind words about their father. So then there began to be other some real unkind things said about me, and so they didn't like that. And so they're now sort of, because they've been able to get both sides or sort of a contrast, they don't get as excited when they see a good article about, say something good about me. Before they used to get very excited, because then in the back of their minds they also think, well, maybe tomorrow they'll have something bad to say. So I guess that in that respect, they're learning quite a bit.
There was one I don't think you mentioned, about teenagers.
It is said that Mexican-American young people are becoming more active in helping their own people. What do you suggest that we Mexican-American teenagers do to help you in your cause?
Well, I think that there are, you know, several things can be done. But one is that you can't really help unless you know what is happening. And the only way you can find out what is going on is to come to the land. You know, we have many people who come here and visit. During the summer, we have volunteers who come here, school kids. During the school vacation, we have people who come here during the weekends. And they work and much work has to be done. All sorts of interesting things have to be done. And then as you do the work, you really begin to understand what's happening. And then once you understand what we're doing, then you can really help. But that's one way. That would be the best way of helping. Now, then the second best way would be to see a movement like ours needs support. In other words, needs to have other people know. And so, like this interview is going to be very helpful. And so you've done quite a bit on that respect. But in your own community, you have problems. And so if you organize there in your community, you can best help us and the poor, whomever they may be, by organizing where you're at.
Very good. Yes.
Yeah.
Good
question. Oh, yeah. The question, I think the question would be, how would you describe the life of an average farm worker as it's seen in the children and the parents? And in other words, the cycle, Caesar, the cycle of poverty that people can't get out of as long as they're enchained as serfs and slaves.
Well, you know, this is something that is very difficult to understand. See, poverty in this country is very difficult to understand by many people because it's right in your own front yard. And it's only until it's far removed, like in Latin America and Asia or in Mexico, that we can understand poverty. So if you have a poor family in West Fresno County, there are a lot of them out there in Mendota and Fireball and those areas. Very poor, extremely poor. And if we go to Fresno and we tell them that there are poor people there in Mendota, this winter they're literally starving. And we also at the same time tell them that there are very poor people in Colombia, that's in Latin America. Then they would tend to believe us a lot more sooner and faster and probably want to do more about Latin America because, see, to understand and know poverty is to admit your own failures here in this country. And even those who have been poor and graduate out of poverty, if we are able to break that barrier, they're the first ones to sort of forget about it. That's why we have so many of the Mexican-American people who go on to get a better education and forget, you know, they leave about it, they don't want anything to do with it. But it's a reminder to them. But also it's an acceptance, you know. If you accept that there's poverty here, then you have to also at the same time accept the fault, so it's more difficult. Now, poverty itself is, it's just the whole question that, the whole matter of, you know, not only being poor but not being able to get out of that cycle. And so my grandfather was poor, and my father is poor, and then I'm poor, and my kids are going to be poor. Now, this is America. This is the land of opportunity and the land of plenty. And yet, you know, this poverty. Now, there's a reason why. Now, it isn't only because we want to be poor or because we are somehow, you know, inferior or because we're lazy. Really, there's some real big reasons. And the real big reasons concerns a farm worker, which is one of the real poorest in this country, is that there is built, you know, a whole set of machinery to keep them poor, because that's the way that other people can stay rich. So, for instance, if in Fresno County, they were to all of a sudden, everybody lives there, including the growers, were to say, we want to do without poverty, do away with poverty. Then we're going to pay $3 an hour and give health and welfare benefits and more educational benefits, the whole works, to the poor. Then that means that they would have less, the rich would have less. And so we're not about to do that. So they force us, you know, to be in this poverty circle. And so if you're poor, then you complicate matters, because if you're poor, then in most cases you're a dropout. And if you're poor in most cases, you're illiterate. And if you're poor in most cases, you can't get away from the environment. And so you may be poor in Rio Grande Valley, Texas, and you come to California, which is supposedly a richer state, but you're still poor because you come down to San Joaquin Valley. And so it seems that everywhere you go, you got that tag. You were tagged when you were born. And this is something that people fail to realize. Fail to realize only because to do so is to admit, you know, our own failures as a society, but also our own failures as individuals. And then the poor then reach a point, it seems to me, where they say, the heck with it, I'm not going to get rich anyway, so what should I worry? Oh, you know, and so that's despair. And but now I think we're going through a new day in America. You know, the poor is like the force that's motivating a lot of change, a lot of things. The poor just getting together and blindly, the best way they can, are protesting. And their protest is being heard by the highest council. It has to be heard because there's so many of us.
Is this only in California where you tried to help? I think Father said you went to Texas.
We tried in Texas, and there we were met with much resistance. We were met there with legal violence, as we call it. There the state used its apparatus, the law and the court and the police powers, to really destroy the union. They tried this in Delano to some extent. They succeeded. But over there, they were very effective. They used the Texas Rangers and the local police